From NPR and WBUR, I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. And not surprisingly today, more job losses, according to the Labor Department. 3.8 million Americans filed jobless claims last week, bringing the six-week total to over 30 million. And that's just those who are able to successfully file a claim. Millions more, we know, haven't even been able to get a call back or reach a human being. Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent, has been looking with the rest of us. And Ali, we know 30 million unemployed, that's about 18% of the American workforce. These are nightmare numbers. And according to the Economic Policy Institute, this could be an undercount by as much as 50%.
Yeah, that's remarkable. So let's say you took the EPI numbers, we could be at, 27%. So let me just give you some perspective. Before coronavirus started, we were at 3.5% unemployment. Very shortly after it started, we got the unemployment numbers for March, but that obviously couldn't be a complete count, but it was at 4.4%. So clearly we knew that was wrong. And there have been estimates ranging from sort of 15% to the mid-20s, and 24% is what we had during the Great Depression. Now, when you get beyond 24%, that means it's something we've never seen. We've had a couple of estimates, including one from the St. Louis Federal Reserve, that says we could get above 30%. A third of all Americans who could be working might be out of work before this is over. And I think we haven't seen the worst of it. While the number of jobless claims is lower than it has been in previous weeks, if we trickled along at this number, this could be much more serious. So economists I've spoken to have said we're probably upward of 18% at the moment. I don't know how deep the undercount is, because it's hard to count these days because so many people have part-time jobs and they have gig jobs and they work a few jobs. But it's very possible that we're upward of 20% right now as we speak.
And this is why many states want to reopen, even though we know, and they probably know, researchers are telling us, there's a second wave of infection that you risk by opening up now. And, some people are going as far as calling it a death knell, if you reopen. Do you think, though, that there's maybe a magic unemployment number out there where public opinion might switch and people might say, the majority of people might say health risks are immense, but how far can we go?
Well, go back to when the first phase of relief went out and the government checks and the extension to unemployment benefits, that's all extended for 3 months, right? That's supposed to be 3 months long. So obviously at that point, we have a couple of choices. One is the government can go for yet more stimulus programs. But at the same time, this isn't like the recession last time. There are a lot of people who are going to say, look, stop us from staying at home and let's see how we can grow. I don't know whether there's a magic number, but there's a point at which people can't sustain their businesses. There's a point at which people can't sustain their bills. There are people who are not paying rent because they can't afford it. But ultimately, at some juncture, phone companies, landlords, people like this are going to say, look, I'm out of options as well. So, this is a big danger because people are starting to consider whether they can risk their health in order to get back to work. And that political pressure is growing on a lot of these governors. And remember, these governors need revenue because they are suffering as well. So the temptation to get to work is understandable and high.
Yeah. Well, and we know that African Americans are getting sick and dying at higher rates. People in the service sector, many who are minority, are getting sick and dying. And I'm thinking that's going to hit the economy as well. It's first of all tragic, but if you've got people, housekeepers who clean emergency rooms and nurses and orderlies, and if they are the ones getting sick and dying, they're the ones right now, the engine running the economy. Look, Ali, what historically can we look at to see what the U.S. should do? Does the government have to pour money into this right now, even if we might pay down the road? And even if unemployment looks really bad in an election year, is there any other alternative?
No, not for the moment. The irony is that it's the only mechanism we have, right? Right now, we've got the Federal Reserve that's able to put money in, and we've got Congress that's able to allocate emergency funding, and then we've got all the resources at the government's disposal, like the National Guard and the CDC and things like that. We don't actually have the equivalent of a Manhattan Project or a moonshot with respect to this virus, right? That we don't have either a global or even a major national strategy on, and that's part of the issue, that we know how to deal with economic stuff, but this isn't fundamentally an economic problem. So until we solve it, yes, the government's going to keep on having to put money into this thing, but at some juncture, until we either have a treatment, a vaccine, or what we call herd immunity that allows people to get back to work, we're in this pickle, and we don't have any visibility as to when one of those things are going to happen. There's a real temptation, remember, to get back to work by September, because that's when schools go back. And for a lot of parents, that's the imperative. And for a lot of college students, that's the imperative. So we may be able to buy a couple more months, but not much more.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent with some, you know, grim news. But thank you, Ali.
Thanks, Robin.
Unemployment in India is also a growing problem. Prime Minister Modi is trying to get the country back to normal, first by allowing millions of people stranded by a nationwide lockdown to return to their home states. He's scheduled to update the country on Sunday. The BBC's Nitin Srivastava joins us from Delhi via Skype. And Nitin, how much pressure is Prime Minister Modi under to further ease these restrictions?
Well, there is a lot of pressure on the Prime Minister to ease the lockdown. And, of course, the number of cases, the corona cases, have gone quite up in India. As of now, today, they stand above 33,000. And the number of deaths has also gone up considerably. As compared to the number of cases, there are more than 1,000 deaths. But yes, the pressure that the Prime Minister has been facing is more about the millions and millions who have been unemployed for the last 1 month. One estimate has suggested that there may be about 100 million people who've lost their jobs in the last 1 month, and they all are from the informal, unorganized sector.
You know, much like the United States, it sounds like this has had a huge impact on the economy. But I want to ask you about those numbers of those who have died and the number of those who have tested positive. 30,000 is an astounding number, but India is huge. It's a country of more than a billion people. There were actually these really dire predictions of millions of coronavirus cases. What's the explanation for this number of 30,000? It's big, but it is not as big as some thought it would be.
So in a country of more than a billion people, in the last month and a half, cases numbering 33,000 with 1,000 deaths looks pretty paltry if you compare it to the cases in the United States, in Spain, in Italy, in the UK. But the other side of the argument is that India has been trying to improve upon its testing. The testing has not been that rigorous so far in India. So that is the other side of the argument. Of course, the government and many experts say that this is a sort of an achievement for a country like India, because everything has been in a complete disarray, complete lockdown. Millions have been stranded away from their homes, mostly migrant workers and all. It's a catch-22 situation for the government and for the people to look after their own people, their livelihood, their food and shelter, and look after the number of cases, which is going up.
I see. Of the 30,000 cases, How has the coronavirus impacted India's densely packed slums?
Well, it has impacted the slums. And what we know for sure is that out of these 33,000, a significant percentage has been from places, from areas which have been densely populated. And that doesn't just include the slums in bigger cities like Mumbai, which has been really badly affected, but it also affects places like Delhi, which doesn't have that much of slums, but which has a small and a seasonable number of villages around itself, where the virus seems to have spread. And that is what the Indian government calls a community spread. And that is why the government has tried to come up and identify hotspot zones, which are completely sealed in the last 2, 3, 4 weeks, to ensure that the community spread of the virus doesn't happen. But yes, as you said, densely populated areas have been the most vulnerable in the last month and a week.
You know, we've been talking a lot here about waves of coronavirus, that the worst may be yet to come. Have officials spoken about this? Are they worried that this might be just the first wave?
Not really. The officials here have been talking about the numbers. So what's happening in India in the last few weeks is that every day the government comes out with official figures about the number of people who were infected in the last 24 hours, the number of deaths which happened in the last 24 hours, the total count of coronavirus infected people, and also the number of people who have recovered from the virus. Nobody's talking about whether we are really in the stage one or two or three or four, whether there has been a plateau of sorts and all. But the government definitely has been talking that the COVID recovery rate right now in India is almost 25%. So the government says that it has been a major improvement for the last 14 days ago, how it was, because it says that out of these 33,000, almost 8,300 patients have recovered, which they feel is a big achievement. But definitely nobody's talking about the stages as of now.
That's the BBC's Nitin Srivastava from Delhi. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Pleasure being with you.
For those who've never been to South Central LA, a mention of the city Compton might bring to mind something like this.
You are now about to witness the strength of street knowledge.
Yes, it's the home of gangster rap. But for author and journalist Walter Thompson Hernandez, Compton also signifies something else. A place where the strong bonds between black men are built through the diligent care of horses.
I grew up about 10 minutes away from here. And I grew up seeing black cowboys. Like, black cowboys was like a very normal thing for me to see.
Walter is talking about the Compton Cowboys. And in his new book released this week, under the same name, Walter chronicles the story of 10 friends continuing the legacy of the original Compton Cowboys, who for more than 30 years were a mainstay in Compton. These cowboys also made it their life's work teaching young kids in South Central LA the possibilities and power of healing through horsemanship.
Essentially, they are, you know, like local superstars, right? Like, everyone stops them for photos. People honk at them, like, hey, black cowboys, like, you guys are looking great. You guys are doing great.
Walter remembers the first time he saw one of the Compton Cowboys on a horse. He was about 5 or 6 in the backseat of his mom's car, and there was this cowboy riding bareback with a quiet confidence, his back long and strong, taking command of this urban landscape. Walter would roll down his window to hear the click-clacking of the horse's hooves on the concrete. And it was only as he got older that Walter realized these men on horses signified something even deeper, and that was the endless possibilities of what he could do in this world as a black man.
I'm the son of a black man and Mexican mother, and so for me, I grew up seeing Mexican cowboys a lot, like brown men on horses was like a normal thing. But also like seeing black men on horses to me was like very important. That was a part of the story that wasn't told to me in school. And I felt like it was a part of history that I would have wanted my teachers to have told me about. And it never was.
The narrative, though, is that cowboys are white.
It is a narrative. And, you know, but history tells us a different story, right? Like history shows us that 1 in 4 cowboys were in fact black. History tells us that like black cowboys had a really prominent role in the founding of the West. And, but at some point during history, there was like erasure that happened. Right. And at some point in history, people started to neglect the black cowboy story, which is what makes this story so important. Like these are a bunch of friends who are trying to reinsert the black cowboys back into the history books.
Walter and I met up at Richland Farm Ranch in Compton in early March before social distancing. A place that's measured in blocks instead of acres, 8 blocks to be exact. It's run by 30-year-old Randy Hook, one of the new generation of Compton Cowboys. They hold weekly classes for kids, teaching them the ins and outs of caring for horses.
That's where we at, Riston Farms, established 1888 by G.D. Compton. He was a farmer, you know.
Really?
Yeah, he used to go to the World Fairs and win all the big, like, awards.
That's Randy showing me the farm, which was originally owned by the founder of Compton back in the 1800s. And if you don't know about this place, you're not going to find it. It's tucked behind a row of unassuming ranch-style houses in the middle of a neighborhood. But it's a bona fide farm. There's a running track and about a dozen horses in their stables.
So these are the kids. That's Polly, Sonny, Fury. That's my horse specifically. He's like a oddball. Babe, this is Candy. We just got her from probably like within the last year from a family up in Santa Barbara, like a rescue situation.
This is a friendly guy.
Oh, this is Coda. She's a little Mustang. She's always wanting to know what's going on.
There's also a garden and a few other farm animals. A llama?
Yeah.
Is that a llama?
Yep. It is. Her name is Sophie. And it's cool. People always do that. Whoa, a llama? Right. So yeah, it's good to have her here too. Because imagine the kids around here get to see like, whoa, what the heck? Like, animal they would literally never see anywhere else.
Randy is one of the main characters in Walter's new book. His aunt, Maisha Akbar, created the Compton Junior Posse Youth Equestrian Program 30 years ago. He and 9 other students of Akbar took it over in 2017. And some of Randy's first memories in life are of caring and training his first horse.
His name was Look at Time. Yeah, look at time. We say it fast, but it's because he's so fast. Every time we would do a run, people would go, whoa, look at the time. Look at
when
that.
When did you first get Look at the Time?
I was probably like 5. I'm like a little kid.
Randy embodies some of the reasons author Walter Thompson Hernandez wanted to tell this story of these new Compton cowboys.
I spent about a year writing this book, and it was a deep sort of like ethnographic project, right? Like I was fully immersed into the story. I was both a participant and an observer, really. And I think that was what was so unique about this, is that usually you have like white people writing about communities of color, but like here I am, a person who identifies with the people who I'm writing about. So I sort of had like a very unique relationship to this story. But I saw so many things, and I think the aspect of this was in fact the children and like how they see the Compton Cowboys.
This farm is set in the middle of a place that consistently has one of the highest crime rates in the nation. It's not easy to grow up here. But caring for horses doesn't just make living here easier. Randy says it gives kids some tools to survive. And he knows this firsthand.
Like, this is Compton. We're not in, like, the outskirts or the countryside. This is the city of Compton. And we grew up here in the 80s, 90s, right? Like, this is, like, the craziest time. You're thinking about, like, crime and drugs. And, you know, you got, like, Rodney King riots and, like, corrupt people, like, government, like our local government corruption and police brutality. I mean, anything you can name that will be wrong with the inner city community, like all happening at once. This is that era. So, and that comes with a lot, you know, it's a lot of challenges. It's a lot of life threatening stuff out there. And having the horses back here allowed us, kept me in the backyard as opposed to being on the front yard, in the front yard. And that's a life or death decision.
Walter's book lays bare some of those life or death decisions, as well as some of the magic that happens when kids get to interact with these animals. Most of the horses are donated, and some come from bad situations. They suffer from PTSD. Others are just wild. They've never been trained before coming here. Somewhere along the way, someone gave up on these horses, threw in the towel. It's a feeling some of these kids can relate to.
That turns out to be a good thing for our program because, you know, it's a relatable emotion that a lot of the kids that come in connect with. You know, it's easy to say, you know, if you have a horse that's traumatized and really reserved or like tweaky, it's easy to say, hey, to a kid who's also like that, you can understand, you feel what she's feeling, right? Aren't you? You feel the same way sometimes, right? It's easy to connect those dots.
And so through the feeding, bathing, and training of these horses, what Randy is teaching is empathy.
You don't, when you don't value a life, it doesn't register you the same to take a life, you know what I'm saying? But when you grow up learning to take care of a horse, take care of some plants, and you develop a value for things that live and breathe and have to grow. So when you're out there on the streets, if you have the value for life, it's harder for you to harm a life.
Do you ever get overwhelmed with emotion thinking about the kids that you help? Because, I mean, I guess in reading the book and just even the small things like teaching the kids how to feed the horses, teaching them that, like, the horse will poop a lot if you feed them too much, you know, like, they won't stop eating and all of these things. Like, they're fun things, but I think about the wonder of a child. They think they're learning just don't feed a horse a lot. But what they're learning is all the things you were talking about to me there. Do you ever feel overcome by just that thought?
Every day. I cry a lot about, and every time people ask me about it, I get it a little emotional because that's what this whole thing is about. You know what I mean? Like, one of my proudest moments in years has been watching one of my students get on that horse and do well. And how she looked, her, like, she was so happy.
This is an expensive endeavor. The Compton Cowboys rely on donations to keep going and donated equipment, which allow them to compete in regional competitions. But what they symbolize for this community, Walter Thompson Hernandez believes, is priceless. At the same time, it's sort of a story about gentrification because they're working so hard to keep this program, but things are changing all around us.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, it is a story about the fear of displacement and what happens to these sacred spaces, what happens to places and communities of color. You know, what's happening here is that this community is changing demographically, right? And I think these are the last Black cowboys. These are one of the last remaining cowboys in this area. And it's not only happening here, right? There are other Black urban cowboy communities across the country who are experiencing similar things in Baltimore, in Philadelphia. And so I think that's the sort of unifying thread, right? Is that every sort of like Black cowboy community in the country right now is experiencing the same thing. The fear of displacement is happening all over.
What do you want people to take away from your book?
At its core, this is a story about geography, I think. I think this is a story about the places that we all go to find redemption and to find healing. And I think for this group of friends, it's a horse ranch in the middle of Compton. But I think this is like a very universal story. That I think this is a story that everyone can really see themselves in, because we all need places to go and redeem ourselves from past experiences, from traumatic experiences. And for me personally, you know, this ranch became somewhere that I went to as well.
Walter, thank you so much for your work.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And as we mentioned, Walter's book, Compton Cowboys, The New Generation of Cowboys and America's Urban Heartland, is out this week. And starting Monday, the governor of Florida, Ron DeSantis, plans to reopen stores and restaurants. He's calling it a slow reopening, which excludes some of the hardest hit areas like Miami-Dade and Palm Beach and Broward counties. Let's check in with Adam Gersten now. He's the owner of Gramps, a bar in Miami, which isn't allowed to open fully. And we spoke with him last month just as he was making the decision to lay off almost all of his staff. Adam, welcome back.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Well, I hear that you've been able to bring back some of the 40 employees you initially had to lay off.
Yeah. We're at about 31 right now and even added a couple new folks. So really something that I wouldn't have expected when we spoke the last time.
Yeah, I know things felt so dire then and you were letting folks out of their jobs so that they could collect unemployment. What's changed for you?
Well, a few things. We got a Florida disaster loan, and then we also applied for PPP and got that. In these days, I would say that's hitting the lottery, you know. Seeing how few people were able to get unemployment was a big factor as well in how we move forward.
Yeah, so your employees are back. Your bar has a partnership with the pizzeria, and you said that at first you didn't really feel like it was worth staying open to just to sell pizza. How is business picking up now?
It's great. The pizza is selling well. We bottled our cocktails. The state waived the restrictions on bars bottling their own cocktails. So you can sell cocktails. And then also we've sold a ton of shirts and, merch kind of stuff. And we've brought in some other vendors. So that's been a lot of fun. People are responding.
Oh, so that means people can can do a takeout.
Yeah. We've got a takeout window. I think it'll stay that way for a while, no matter what. It's just easy and safe for, I guess, for the employees. So I think we have a lot of outdoor space. So I think that's going to be the mode for a while.
That's really interesting in thinking about how your business will operate from this point on. I know that part of your reasoning when we talked to you a few weeks ago to close, even before these lockdown measures, was because your bar is always very busy and you really worried about the crowds during spring break. So you see this as a natural progression, is that takeout would be a primary part of your business.
Yeah. Yeah, we had a meeting yesterday. And I said, guys, this isn't just like a little fad thing. We should look at this as though we've really created a new functioning arm of the same business and want to see it be part of, you know, whatever the future is.
Yeah. Your bar is named after your grandfather, and listeners may remember he had just passed right before you made that hard decision to close.
Mm-hmm.
You know, running a business, caring for a family, just staying afloat, it's a lot. How are you doing?
I love the extra family time. That's been just amazing. You know, it helps you see the balance if, you know, you're one of the folks like me who forgets that often. And so that's been really nice, actually, and comforting, you know.
Yeah. Adam Gersten is owner of Gramps, a bar in Miami. And Adam, thank you so much, and you take care.
Thanks. Thanks for having me again. Thanks.
The coronavirus pandemic has disrupted elections across the country. Earlier this week, New York State canceled its Democratic primary in June. And in other states, candidates running for office are encountering barriers to getting on the ballot. Roberto Roldan reports from Richmond, Virginia.
Community organizer Alan Charles Chipman started planning his run for Richmond City Council months ago. But then the coronavirus stay-at-home and social distance directives went into effect. Now, he's not so sure that he can gather the 125 voter signatures that he'll need to actually appear on the ballot.
As a candidate, I kind of have a hard choice, right? I should not have to choose between exercising my constitutional right to run versus complying with the law and not endangering my community.
Chipman and other candidates for a local office in Virginia are required to get their qualifying signatures in by June 9th. One day before Governor Ralph Northam's stay-at-home order is scheduled to end. Candidates running for mayor in Richmond have it even harder. They need 50 voter signatures from each of the city's 9 political districts. Tracy McLean, a small business owner who's running for mayor, says she's tried to think of some creative ways to go door-knocking for signatures, but she still runs a risk of turning off potential voters.
I think you also will be looked at in a different light. Some people might be like, oh, you're risking my health.
One of McLean's competitors, lawyer and activist Justin Griffin, says he only has about half the signatures that he needs.
It's a matter of public health, and we should be adapting to that and figuring out ways to do this while maintaining ballot access and keeping everybody as healthy as possible.
Griffin and other potential candidates want the state to accept e-signatures, or at the very least, extend the filing deadline. If that doesn't work, candidate Alan Charles Chipman says he plans to file a court petition against the state's Department of Elections.
I think the Virginia Board of Elections understands that, but there's nothing they can do without a court order. So this might be a way to give a solution that they can kind of get behind.
Most of the states that have been moving toward alternatives to qualify for the ballot have been compelled to do so by the courts. An Arkansas group has filed a lawsuit claiming collecting signatures during the pandemic is impossible. The Massachusetts Supreme Court recently ruled in favor of 3 candidates who asked for a deadline extension and a 50% reduction in how many signatures are needed. And in Michigan, a judge also extended the signature deadline and forced the state to accept e-signatures. Even when candidates manage to collect enough signatures to get on the ballot, the coronavirus pandemic has changed local campaigning dramatically. Ask Amy Wentz. She's running for Richmond City Council. She's already submitted her signatures, but she's had to scramble to create a strategy for reaching voters online.
This was the month that we were supposed to start knocking on doors and just having some one-on-one time with voters where I could talk about my platform and just try to get my face out there as much as possible.
Now, the six town halls that she was supposed to hold in person are going digital. Other candidates, like Justin Griffin, are holding virtual meet and greets where voters can schedule a time to speak with him one-on-one. Griffin says candidates will have to be creative in their outreach, even as the stay-at-home order is lifted.
I think people are going to be wary of opening their doors, interacting with strangers, congregating in large places for a little while.
But for now, Griffin says he'll need state officials to intervene if he hopes to qualify for the ballot by June. For Here and Now, I'm Roberta Roldan in Richmond.
Well, some of you have probably noticed the obituary section expanding in your local paper, even if the paper itself has been shrinking. The Boston Globe had a record 21 pages of death notices last Sunday. Well, newsrooms across the country are enlisting sports and hard news reporters to now write about the many lives lost. Chrissy Katowski covered child welfare and social justice and criminal justice for the Chicago Tribune. She now heads up the Trib's obituary team, a tender job. Chrissy, your thoughts on doing this?
I really think it's an honor. At first, there was just a few of us on the team, and now it's pretty much all corners of the newsroom are writing what we described as life stories of many of our COVID-19 victims. And I just feel it's an honor to be able to tell their stories, comfort their families, and help inform the public of the, you know, the human toll of this pandemic.
Tell us about some of the stories that have touched you.
The stories about the healthcare workers, the nurses and doctors who die of COVID-19 are incredibly difficult. And the firefighters and police officers are frontline heroes. I did a piece on families struck more than once by this. Can you imagine? The elderly couple married for 60 years who died within hours of each other and on the same floor of a hospital bed. The husband who gave up the ventilator so someone younger could have it. After learning his wife had died, those stories strike me, and the common man too. The children of depression that we're writing about, all of them, you know, are so meaningful and are just an incredibly moving storytelling.
So everything you just said pierced, but the man who gave up his ventilator.
Yeah, this was a couple who they were both in the early 80s, and a friend described them as the real life Ozzie and Harriet. One was rarely without the other, and they were stricken down by COVID-19 and died within hours of each other. So that was one of at least 12 families that we found that had more than one death. Just heartbreaking.
Oh, it is. I'm looking at that article in particular, and some of your lines jumped out at me. The coronavirus can rewrite a family's history without warning. You know, the sense of shock, you know, the two Greek-American brothers watching the caskets of both their father and mother be lowered into the ground. It's stunning. And we're reminded this is not a death notice. These are crafted pieces. It's more along the lines of the Portraits of Grief. Janie Scott, the New York Times reporter, came up with that great idea after 9/11 to really tell a story of everyone who died when the towers fell in New York.
It's interesting that you brought up that example too, Robin, because that is kind of, you know, we thought of 9/11 when we came up with this idea. We have different teams focusing on different things throughout the newsroom, and we're lucky to have enough staff to do that, like healthcare and, you know, PPEs and statistics. But for the obit team, we wanted to tell the life stories much like we did with 9/11. And for me, I'm well equipped for it. Ask me in a couple weeks if I'm still doing so well with it. But if I may, just on a personal note, I lost my father in August of 2018 to cancer, very different situation. But I can't help but draw a bit, you know, from personal feelings about that. And he was a man who didn't finish high school or make a lot of money in life, but he read his daily newspaper every day, and he knew everything going on in his community and the country. And I was always inspired by the fact that whether you're Donald Trump or my father, you have the same access to education. And I feel the same way about these obits, whether you're, you know, a rich doctor from Winnetka or a impoverished man living in the south side of Chicago, you are getting equal play on the storied pages of the Chicago Tribune. And I'm deeply proud of that. Mm.
You know, why do you think that kind of detail is important for your readers?
It's so we don't want these lives to be a data point or a statistic. We want to drive home to the public their deep importance in this world. And I say, what do you think your father or wife or brother valued most in life? And the answer has been the same for every single one, and it's family. Mm. And that's what these stories are about, reminding us of family and what we mean to each other.
That's Chicago Tribune reporter, now head of that paper's obituary team, as I try to wrestle with all the different lives lost to COVID-19, and making sure, Christy, as what is the line from Death of a Salesman, you know, attention must be paid.
Absolutely.
Well, they're lucky to have you. Thanks so much.
Robin, thank you.
The NCAA took a step forward this week on a topic that's been a subject of much debate, whether to compensate college athletes who make so much money for the organization and the schools. The NCAA's Board of Governors said yesterday it supports a plan that gives athletes the ability to cash in on their names, images, and likenesses without any involvement from the association, schools, or conferences. And Mike Pesca is Here and Now sports analyst, and he hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, on Slate.com, and he joins us now. And Mike, this is just one step, but it's actually a big one.
It's a pretty big one, but let's think about and talk about what it's not. What it's not is colleges paying the players directly. So there is still amateurism, a type of amateurism at play, and that's very important to the NCAA, and it would, in fact, destroy their business model were it not to be the case. But what it does is it takes these college players who are often really prominent and really famous. And in the case of football players and some basketball players, their schools might print up jerseys with their number and the numbers fly off the shelf. And the college player says, why am I not allowed to get any taste of this? So the NIL, name, image, and likeness, can be sold. That opens up, whether you think of it, opportunities or a can of worms, how they define how it can be sold, what constitutes the name, image, and likeness. So a couple things that are important to note. A few years ago, there used to be these video games, NCAA 2009, when the college players would essentially be represented in the game. It's going to be hard to do that because the NCAA does not allow group licensing, so all college players can't sign a big contract. But one player can, say, do an autograph signing, or one player can get a lot of money from a shoe company, or one player can have could be defined as a social influencer and get, I don't know, $5,000 to $500,000 if the social influencing company thinks they're worth it. That will be allowed.
Okay, so we've been talking about this for a really long time. I know there has been quite a bit of opposition for this. What happens next?
Well, the NCAA has to work out a lot of the fine details. They have to make it the case that a booster can't just use this as an end around to essentially bribe a kid or pay a kid to come to the school. Hey, sign an autograph. It's worth $100,000. Guess what? You're going to University of Arkansas now. Plus, there's a lot of different legislation in different states and even the federal government. And the NCAA wants some protections from the federal government, whereas the House of Representatives also has a bill on the table to essentially force the NCAA to give a more liberal definition of name, image, and likeness. It's not done, but I think they've bought some time, maybe a little goodwill.
Okay. Okay. All right. You know, college sports really, to some extent, serves as kind of like the minor leagues for pro sports. We've had athletes in the past, Kobe Bryant, for example, skip that process, but it's been rare. But there's news this week that might actually shake up that system. Tell us more about it.
Well, the NBA has what's called the G League, which is a little bit like the minor leagues. But think about what minor league baseball does. It does a few things. One, it's an apprenticeship program for future stars. But two, it's also a way station for players who are sort of not great enough to be a regular on a major league roster. But maybe a club would want to call that player up for a week at a time. And then when a star is rehabbing, they could get some games in the minor leagues. The G League has essentially not been that apprenticeship for the great players. The great players just go. But now they're getting more into that game, and they are paying directly. The NBA is paying directly $500,000 for potential future stars to go and essentially not play right in the NBA, but skip the college process. So this is setting up the NBA itself and its affiliated teams a little bit against colleges, which have been so good over the years grooming the players. A lot of players can now just opt into, I will play professionally at this somewhat minor league level, like baseball players used to do. It's a new opportunity for players, and maybe it weakens the lore of going to an NCAA school.
Yeah. Okay, I want to ask you one more thing. I mean, you know, everybody's thinking about this question. Are we really any closer to any of the major sports leagues either resuming their seasons or, in the case of baseball, actually starting their seasons?
Well, what baseball's done is they've floated a plan. And on the one hand, you could say it's good that they're thinking about this in case the world opens up. On the other hand, it does seem that the plan is a little optimistic about when the world can open up. They're talking about, let's start training in June. Let's have games on July 2nd or the 4th of July, and we could brand that America's back and baseball is back. One plan is to have there was the original plan, let's all sequester the players in Arizona. Players didn't like that. Now they're saying, let's have them play in their major league stadiums. Let's have them travel less than they normally would, but let's maybe do it with empty stadiums. And if permissible by fall, get some people in there to watch. Again, I don't want to say it is good that the league is thinking about this. I don't know that this thought coincides with the best thinking about where we are on testing and antibodies and the actual reality of the virus. And then you have situations like, you know, Toronto's a team in Major League Baseball. They're not following the rules of America. Different cities, you look at these state compacts, what the Atlanta Braves might do and what the New York Yankees might do might be two entirely different things. So that's where we are.
Yes. Mike Pesca, Here and Now sports analyst. He's the host of the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. Mike, as always, thank you.
You're welcome.
And Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.